Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts, Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters, bring you the amazing stories of people who answered the call to unlock their potential and taken control of their own success with authenticity, creativity, persistence, and resilience. Close Up Radio special guests share their knowledge and wisdom so you, the listener, can live the most empowered life possible. Close Up Radio. And now, here's today's host, Jim Masters.
Thanks so much for joining us, everybody. We're live worldwide on Close Up Radio Live. It's a pleasure to have you here. It's also a pleasure to continue our extraordinary series with Dr. Michael Armour. You know, for decades, Dr. Mike, as he's popularly known, he's compiled this exceptional leadership record in far-ranging fields of endeavor, and he is a multi-dimensional achiever. And that consistently puts him in demand as an executive coach, business advisor, and trainer focused on management, leadership, cultural transformation, and lots more. He's recognized as a best-selling author as well in multiple business categories for his book, Leadership and the Power of Trust. And he's also a dynamic public speaker. I've had an opportunity to see that in action when we flew to Dallas for a television shoot, and I saw him with a packed audience who was intently listening to every word he had to say, which he said so eloquently as well, and received a standing ovation after his speech to the audience. So again, he is a dynamic public speaker. As an acknowledged expert in the fields of coaching and leadership, Dr. Mike really has wise and timely advice to share with all of us, and he's been doing it in the new year as well. Hopefully you've been following along, reminding you we archive all of the episodes in the series. So you can go back and you can share the episodes, you can share the links, and there might be folks you think also could really use the invaluable information we've been sharing here on the series, and whether that's personal or managerial in nature. In the first of those series, we've been, you know, of course, you may remember, we talked kicking really things off in a beautiful way with New Year's wishes, and then talking about understanding conflict in the workplace. And now we're talking about a framework for resolving conflict, which is really important. We've got lots to get to, so I'm going to dive right in here and welcome him back to our show and series, coming to us live from Dallas, Texas. Dr. Mike, thank you very much for joining us here on the program. It's always a pleasure to have you here, and welcome back.
I'm always glad to be back with you, Jim. We have very interesting conversations, don't we?
Yes, we do. And now we're going to tackle something that I know is very relevant, a framework for resolving conflict. And sometimes people resolve conflict in ways that are, you know, not necessarily smooth as silk. Sometimes there's violent verbal ways. Sometimes there's neglect or just walking in another direction and nothing gets resolved. So there's, especially in the workplace, there are very strategic ways, different ways that management can help resolve conflict. Last week, we introduced the topic of management's responsibility to handle conflict in the workplace appropriately, but we had little time because, you know, it was jam-packed that half hour with the topic. We had little time to really expand on how to deal with conflict when it does occur. So this time on this episode, let's dig in deep and spend some time on that as well. What, from your perspective, being, you know, in the thick of it all these years in various ways, shapes, and forms, wearing many different hats in your career, what are some of those basics as to how leaders should deal with workplace conflict? I imagine one of them in the beginning, just throwing this out there, is nipping it in the bud quickly before it escalates.
That's exactly right. In fact, I would suggest that probably the most common mistake that we make as leaders and managers with conflict in the workplace is that we wait too long to address it. Now, sometimes that's not necessarily the leader or the manager's fault. It can often occur simply because as the leader or manager, I'm not aware of the conflict until it has really gotten very serious and it's been called to my attention by some disgruntled employee. But I'm working with a situation right now which is highly conflicted, and the CEO didn't realize the degree of the conflict until just recently, because it was going on out of his hearing and away from his observation. But nonetheless, for reasons that we touched on last week, many people are conflict averse, even though they are in management and leadership roles. And their first inclination when conflict breaks out is just to let it run its course and maybe it will take care of itself. What almost inevitably occurs is that it simply becomes more complex to solve the problem, because while waiting for the conflict to resolve itself, it simply takes on new layers of complication, and the intensity of the emotions behind the conflict become more pronounced. When we step into these kinds of conflicted situations, one of the other mistakes that leaders and managers will commonly make is not showing proper empathy for the parties on both sides of the conflict. Anytime conflict occurs, emotions get stirred and people become more attuned to the emotions they're feeling than the specifics of the grievance that they have. Oh, they can tell you what the grievance is and can probably sum it up pretty quickly. But what is really driving their behavior, what is driving their attitude, what is driving the tone of their voice is the emotion that they feel. And until we acknowledge those emotions, so that as the arbiter, the mediator, the boss, the supervisor, the manager, the leader who has stepped in to try to bring these warring parties back together, until we have acknowledged their feelings, we're not likely to have the kind of credibility with the parties on both sides that is needed in order for our recommendations and observations to be taken seriously. And therefore, it's very important to say, I understand you've got deep feelings on this. Tell me a little bit about what's behind those feelings, and make the overture to understand their feelings before you really move into trying to resolve the causes of the conflict. One of the other things that happens, though, is that too often we deal with the immediate conflict and not the deeper conflict that's running really in the background and triggering the situation that we're confronting at present. That's very common, particularly in the nonprofit world, where there's sort of this golden rule that everybody ought to be nice with one another. And so conflict tends to be dealt with at a superficial level rather than leadership digging deeply into the roots of the conflict. And what happens is we patch over the conflict today, and a few weeks later, a few months later, I've even seen a few years later, the conflict comes back even worse because the underlying issues never got addressed. It's also very important as leaders and managers that we not take sides before fully investigating the actual sources of the conflict. The fact of the matter is some employees are far more articulate, far more persuasive than others. And if you have a highly articulate, highly persuasive employee who's in conflict with employees who are not so articulate or as persuasive, it's easy for the manager to be drawn into the conflict on the side of the more persuasive party, rather than saying there are two sides to this story and I'm not going to begin recommending a course of action or a resolution until I thoroughly understand both sides of the story. And then that then confronts us with something that is really important, and that is being sure that we separate facts from interpretation of the facts. When the two warring parties start telling us what the conflict is, we're going to be hearing an admixture of facts and their interpretation of the facts. But they will never say, this is my interpretation of the facts. They will state their interpretation as just another of the facts. We therefore have to be ready to ask the kinds of probing questions that will help us clarify in our own mind as to what the facts are and what are the interpretations of the facts. Both are important because the facts we've got to be in agreement on before we can resolve the difference. If we're not agreed that the facts are the same, agreed on the facts and don't see them the same way, it will be very difficult to bring about agreement. But it is my interpretation of the facts that is driving that emotion I was talking about a while ago. And until I, as the intervener, can understand how their interpretation of the facts is feeding their emotion, I'm not going to be able to deal effectively with the emotion. And as I said a while ago, if we don't address the emotion properly, we may be able to gloss the conflict over for the moment, but the emotion still running in the background will bring it back to the surface at some future date.
Very important to realize that. And when you find yourself trying to diffuse conflict when it occurs, is there an overall framework of reference, or is there a working model that you use?
I do have some working models that I use, and models that I use quite often in training managers and leaders, how they can be most effective in resolving conflict that they suddenly have tossed in their lap in the course of their duties. We discussed last week that when I am doing a management training program for less experienced managers, those that have been in their role 5 or 6 years or less, one of the things I will routinely ask is what has been your greatest surprise in the management role? And the most frequent response is, and it's a close tie between a response that says the number of people issues I have to deal with, and the second response, the amount of conflict that I have to resolve, the number of times I'm drawn into conflicted situations. And that's the one that weighs on them the most, because they don't really feel equipped to handle the conflict as well as they should like. So I try to provide them a model for understanding how to go at conflict. And the one that I have found very simple to explain, although I will tell you it's easier to explain if I've got a visual surface on which to map some things. I'm going to have to depend on verbiage instead of drawings to communicate some things today. But it is a model that was developed by my longtime friend, Randy Lowry. Randy and I were on the faculty and administration at Pepperdine University together at the same time. I was dean of students and director of external graduate programs. He was the head of the Institute for Dispute Resolution in the Pepperdine School of Law. Later went on to be president of David Lipscomb University in Nashville, Tennessee. Randy and I did a lot of conflict mediation work together, and he wrote a tremendous book on how to mediate conflict in particularly church and nonprofit scenarios. And in his model, we focus on three things: the issue, the positions that people are taking on that issue, and the concerns which those positions create for them. Now, this is fundamentally how the model works. We start off by isolating what the issue is that we're fighting about, because usually by the time we as managers and leaders are drawn into very serious conflict, they're fighting over a lot of different issues. But we have to dialogue with the parties on both sides and say, what is the issue that if we resolved it, these other issues would go away or at least become far less emotionally charged? It takes some time on occasion to get that clear, crisp definition, but I want it not only to have the issue identified, I want us to write it down. And if I'm working with a conflict in a place where I can do it, I'm going to write it on a whiteboard or write it on a flip chart. I'm certainly going to write it out on a piece of paper and put it before us as the conversation continues if I'm not in one of those situations. Now, why do I want the issue written out? It's because in the course of trying to resolve the conflict, people will start changing the issue. And we've got to have a control that we say, no, the issue is this. You're bringing up something else. If that's also an issue, we will deal with it at another time. Right now, we are dealing with this issue. So we have to have that control of having them agree before we begin as to what the issue is. Otherwise, you think you're making progress, and then one party or the other starts saying, well, that's not really what we're talking about. Because maybe for some reason they don't want a resolution of the conflict, and they see that you're moving them toward a resolution, and so they change the issue to derail the process. So what is the issue? And we get that defined. Now, then the way that Randy and I illustrate it, I borrowed from his model and amplified it for my own purposes, is we picture this issue as a wall standing between the two parties. And it's as though the two parties are on opposite sides of this wall, lobbing hand grenades over the wall at one another. From that grenade lobbing position they are in, I want to know, what is your position on this? And again, I want that to be clear enough that we can write it down in a bulleted list. My position is boom, 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 boom. And you turn to the other party. What is your position? Boom, 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 boom. Once we have the positions defined and written down, then it's, Randy calls it drawing the line under the positions. You draw a line under the positions, and you go below that line in a graphic display of what you're doing, and you ask people to start identifying their concerns that drive them to that position. What is it you're concerned about that drives you to take that position? And that then becomes the structure in which we break this problem down, this conflict down, into pieces that we can work with individually. Identify the issue, identify the positions, and then identify the concerns that are driving people to those positions.
You know, the way that you just described that, you can almost visualize some of this in action, which leads me to want to know more about the actual approach. Tell us more about the actual approach and how the model actually works in application.
The fact of the matter is that when we try to resolve conflict, our natural instinct is to step into the actual conflict itself and try to find a quick resolution. We do this as parents when we have kids fighting. Each one of them wants to tell his or her side of the story as to what caused this fight. And we as parents are quick to say, I'm not interested in that. Just stop fighting. Just no more of that. And we are in an authority position where we can sometimes impose that will. But in workplace conflict, in social conflict, in civic conflict, in political conflict, we can't impose our will. And so we have to work the total problem, not just the conflict, but what are the issues, what is from a condensation of the issues, the issue that is our great concern. And what are the positions we've taken on those? And then what are the concerns underneath those positions? Because if we come up with a solution that doesn't address those concerns, people may give us a surface agreement to the solution. The fact that their concern isn't addressed in the solution simply means that they will continue to be agitated and emotionally upset about it. And that agitation and emotional upset will keep the conflict going at that deeper level that I was talking about a while ago. So our ultimate focus is going to be on the concerns, not the issue, because all kinds of good can come out of talking about the concerns. Maybe we can discuss that a bit later, but the model works to get us away from the issue and to the concerns, because until we address the concerns on both sides in a substantive enough way that people can feel that their concerns have been heard and adequately addressed, the issue is not going to go away.
That's right. You got to tackle it first, and then hopefully these things are resolved in a way that is, conducive to the atmosphere being positive. So you would say then that the starting place really is to initially identify the issue or issues around mm-hmm. which this conflict resolves or evolves, we hope it resolves. And why start there? How do you actually go about it? I mean, it sounds great when we hear the ideas, but how do we actually go about mastering this?
I used the word a while ago to describe this as a means of establishing control, particularly as managers and leaders. We find ourselves dealing with conflict that has been going on in the background perhaps for some time before we knew about it. It was a clash of personalities, just general discontent with a fellow worker. And things have been simmering and things have been building. And so a lot of issues have developed around that cluster. It's important that we not chase all of those issues. We'll never get resolution. The model is based on the premise that we resolve one issue at a time. And so we take all of these side issues and we are trying to move from them to the issue, that if we resolve it, the other issues are not so important. They don't carry so much weight. They don't carry so much emotion. And that takes quite a bit of dialogue and willingness to stick with it with the parties until we get that issue identified. Because if we're going to have a successful intervention, we've got to be agreed about what we're fighting over. Otherwise, we're just chasing rabbits. I'm trying to get a control in place by saying, okay, this is the issue. What are your positions on this issue? And then when they start talking about their positions on other issues, that's when I say, well, we'll deal with that issue at some other time. Right now, what is your position on this issue? And we're therefore containing or constraining the conversation to a finite enough latitude that we've got some prospect of solving the issue. And the only way to do that is to be agreed in up front as to what the issue is and agreed that the positions we're taking all relate to that issue, and then that the concerns we have are all related to those positions that we've taken on that issue. So it really is, Jim, trying to get a mechanism in place by which we can limit the scope of the conversation so that the topic we're dealing with has a reasonable chance of being resolved in whatever limited time we have to get to a solution.
That's right. And sometimes you got to move quickly on it, depending on what's happening, sort of stop that train from being derailed. So you start with the issue, then define the respective positions, and you put the issue in written form. Do you also put the positions in themselves in writing?
Yes, as much for my own benefit as theirs. because I'm trying to stay above the fray and monitor everything that's going on and track the process and be sure that we're following the model. I may find myself 10 minutes later not remembering exactly what the positions are. That's why I'm suggesting that we need to write the positions down in a series of bulleted statements so that we can call those parties back to it. Because just as the issue will change in the course of the discussion, people's positions will change. And so we want them committed up front that this is my position. Then if they change it, we say, okay, now earlier you said this was your position. Now you're saying something different. Which one is really your position? And again, we're trying to get definition so that we've got control of where the conversation will take us.
And that's what you need, the gaining of the control. At this point, you know, we've defined the issue and we've really designed those positions, which is invaluable. The third piece is to identify the concerns which are behind those respective positions. And I believe you also have indicated that once the concerns are listed, then you focus on them, not the positions, and you explain that strategy. One other quick thing while we're talking about this, I wanted to just throw in, which I think ties quickly to this, and I just thought of this during this conversation. How do you, while doing all of this, how do you regulate emotion? Because a lot of times it's emotional responses that make the conflicts more dramatic and going into a left field situation. So how do we tie all this in and make sure we keep our emotions, we can express ourselves, but not let that get out of whack? Because emotion plays into so much of these conflicts and these situations.
That's an excellent point. And quite honestly, one of the ways I do it is by pre-framing the discussion by saying there's a conflict here, and whenever we have conflict, we all have strong emotions. It's very important that as we work to resolve the conflict, we keep the emotions out of the discussion as much as possible and really focus on the facts and the conditions that have led to the conflict. And so from time to time, I may ask you to park something that I'm hearing that's getting us too far afield into emotion and to come back and state what you're wanting to state, but without quite so much emotion behind it. And that's all in the interest of us being able to resolve this as quickly as possible. And I sort of pre-frame the conversation that way so that later when I start calling people to account, in fact, I will make that pre-frame and then I'll say, is that agreeable to everyone? Because I want their consent. Because if they're not willing to park their emotion, we're probably not going to be able to resolve this thing. So I will say, is that agreeable to everyone? And once they've nodded their head, then I can call them back to that agreement later on if I do have to say to someone, could we put some of the emotion aside and just state this without quite so much emotional energy in our tone and in our voice?
I like that. Great strategy. Great way to break it all out in such a user-friendly way, too. And I encourage folks, check out a couple of websites here, leaderperfect.com, also michaelarmour.com. And he spells his last name A-R-M-O-U-R, if you've ever wondered through all of these fabulous conversations. Dr. Mike, always a pleasure. And I love the strategy. I love the way that you break it all out in a way that is applicable to right now today. Because you put so much time and effort into all of this. And I encourage folks as well to consider going to the website and learn about Leadership and the Power of Trust, which I know is another work of art of yours. Always a pleasure, Dr. Mike, having you with us here on the show.
It's always a joy to be with you. And I look forward to every conversation that we have.
Absolutely. And you'll be back on the 29th next week at 2 Eastern. We look forward to the conversation then and invite us all to join once again here on Close Up Radio Live for that. LeaderPerfect.com, MichaelArmour.com, two great starting points for you. Thanks for joining us, everybody, on this episode of Close Up Radio. We thank our very special guest, Dr. Michael Armour, for joining us here on the program. We'll be back next week as we continue, and we look forward to that. Join us then. Till then, stay right where you are. Grab a cup of coffee. I'll be back in 30 minutes with another fabulous guest celebrated here on Close Up Radio Live. Till then, for all of us, have a terrific day. Thanks for listening, and bye for now.
You have been listening to a broadcast from Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.